With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Welcome to this week's Vale Critics podcast. I'm Steve Norman, joined this week by Paul Field.
Evening, fellas.
Matt Lamborn.
Howdy, guys.
And an extremely happy Owen Hughes after what he's just watched.
Yeah, fuck off, you dickhead.
We'll go straight into the quiz. And for those of you who don't know, haven't listened much, the loser of the quiz inevitably has to watch something bad because we never recommend anyone anything good to watch. So Paul found a film called Essex Space Bin, and I made Owen watch it. And Owen is going to review Essex Space Bin for us now.
There is no point reviewing this.
Well, there is.
I had to look. It's not going to be. There is no review. There is no review. Basically, what happened was Essex Space Bin is a film that prides itself, right? Its whole conceit is that it is a bad movie. Like, they set out purposefully to make a bad film. And then with each scene, as it progresses, they try their hardest to make it worse as it goes on. That's like literally what they wanted to do with it. It is not a fucking movie. It's not a movie. I don't care how much that they think it's got some kind of weird artistic.
Can you tell us what the plot is?
No, there is no fucking plot.
There must be.
Is a plot because I've seen it as well.
There is a woman called Lorraine who is mental.
I've heard it described as the Susan Boyle of movies.
It's not that. Isn't like she's. When I say mental, I'm being facetious, but I actually mean she's crazy. She's loopy, and it turns out it's because she was dipped in Agent Orange when she was a kid, like when she was a baby. So that's the explanation for it. But what she's trying to do is create a portal to another world that she thinks. She can only do in Essex.
Of course.
So your first encounter with this character, in the loosest possible sense of the word character, she's built a big arch out of fried chicken boxes, covered herself in tinfoil, and is attempting to walk through it to enter a portal into another world.
There's always tinfoil, Owen. Always. With a loony, there's always tinfoil.
This is what I mean. They've done that intentionally, knowing that it's crap, that it's an awful cliche. So you're watching it. You can't impartially like review this. It's down as a comedy sci-fi. It's neither. It isn't anything.
Isn't that portal in Essex just a Dartford tunnel?
It's like I say, it's made out of chicken boxes. It's not a, it. It's basically she's crazy. So then you see, like, it's supposed to be like a weird British thing, right? So everything in it is an exaggerated version of a real thing, except it then tries to retain a sense of reality while having mad robot donkeys and stuff and weird, like, space gods that are dogs. Because, you know, gods and dogs, it's... And it's just, I couldn't stand it. I couldn't stand it at all. I got to like 20 minutes in and I was just about ready to fling my TV into the fucking fireplace.
Do you know one of the reasons, that not just that it was bad, because I was thinking, I would not want to have to want to try and review this. That would be the most painful listening imaginable, because it's just, it just makes no sense. It's beyond, almost impossible to review.
It's beyond reviewable. And you, I've read some stuff like Starburst had a review. I went and had to look on, you know, Starburst magazine. I had to look on their website because they pick up some of these crazier things from time to time. And they're going, oh, yeah, it's like this quintessentially English comedy that's just really wacky. It's not really wacky. It's shit. But that's the point, is that it's shit. And so it's not wacky. It's just a fucking excruciating experiment.
But if they set out to make the worst film ever made, and they made the worst film ever made, does that not mean it's the best film ever made?
No, no, that is giving them what they want. You can't. It's not possible to say that it's good because it's intentionally bad. If it's intentionally bad and it's bad, they've done a good job, but it's still a fucking abortion of a piece of shit.
So, Owen, can I ask you, will you be coming to the premiere of this?
What, the PCC?
Yeah, with Lloyd Kaufman.
Uncle Lloyd.
Can't
no,
Uncle Lloyd.
I will not. It's a fuck. No, that's the thing, right? It's a British film. It was made in Britain, but it's been picked up by Troma. Because there is an element to it where it will, in a weird way, make a little bit of money for someone. And that's the one, it turns out, is going to be probably Troma. Because it's going to get a reputation as a cult film. Because it is different. And I am sick of conventional movies. And I do like to try things that are a bit unique. But that doesn't equal good. That doesn't equal watchable. That doesn't equal an enjoyable experience. It's not funny. And it's meant to be. It's painful.
I did laugh at the two fellas nicking the tellies and the old lady being pulled along in the coffin, but other than that, it was no.
Yeah, but then like you, I would have felt like I was giving in to what they wanted, and I was so fucking cross with them, the two directors, that I wasn't prepared to do that.
I mean, I was. I've got to ask you, because you know I've seen a lot of shit films, I mean.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is the worst film I've ever endured. What about you?
It's not the worst film. I'm not even going to give them the fucking satisfaction of saying it is the worst film.
So what is worse?
Worse? Well, I mean, you know, fucking Blair Witch 2 Book of Shadows, probably worse as
really?
A film.
If I,
yeah,
if
Catwoman with Halle Berry is a worse
no,
film. Because
no,
those really. Films have not set out to make a bad film. But so, those films have set out to be
okay.
an entertaining, watchable movie.
If I had a gun to your head and said, oh, I'm going to shoot you now unless you watch Catwoman or Essex Space Bin or Kill Keith or Essex Space Bin, what would you pick?
I'd say put the gun in my mouth and pull the fucking trigger.
All right, what if I put it to your wife's head? Let's be really harsh about this.
I'd say, I love you, dear, but, you know. No, I just think, like, it's not... You can't measure it against those movies. You can't. The only thing you can measure against them is the experience that you had with it. And like I say, you can judge Catwoman as a bad film. You can judge Book of Shadows as a bad film because that's just an unfortunate consequence of what happened during the production of those movies. Essex Space Bin is purposefully designed to elicit this feeling that I have about it.
Oh, it's
and so it works. I'm not denying it's not done its job. I'm just saying that that's not justifiable. I can't articulate how I feel about this film.
I don't know what you guys are talking about. I think it sounds like the best film ever. And it's quite clearly going to be this year's Mob Ended.
Well, Matt,
that's the problem though, because it is going to be this year's Mob Handed, and I really do not want to give this more airtime.
Well, Matt, let's make a deal then. As this quiz is first of three, I've got to plug away to get three points. But if we lose tonight, you have to watch it.
I'll watch it for free. Don't worry about it.
Well, it's on Amazon Prime.
Oh, beautiful! I've got Amazon Prime. That's
I hope you enjoy.
I actually stumbled across it on Amazon Prime. I wasn't looking for anything. I think I was on the like horror section or comedy or whatever, and it was literally like the last title on there. And I thought, how bad can it be?
How bad can it be?
Right, should we do the quiz, boys?
Oh,
are you finished with Essex Space, Ben Owen?
I am just about done, I think.
I'll make you watch it again.
Just to... It's got 4.5 stars on Amazon. That far.
It's got 4.5 fucking stars on Amazon. I don't. That is just like the 13 people who've actually seen the movie who were involved with it, I think.
I just don't think you get it.
I think I get it.
Do you know what killed it for me? Right at the start in the titles when it came up with like the Chelmsford Film Society.
Yeah. Yeah, but that's because that, like, that's what... It's not a Troma film in the sense that Troma created it. So it's not part of Tromaville. It's not got the quirky humour of a Troma movie. It's there's no tits in it either, which I think, given Lorraine, is probably a good thing.
What, mentally ill 50-year-old woman? No.
Who's with one tooth and, breast below her knees. I mean, it's not... It's just, it doesn't feel like a Troma film. But that's what I mean when I say it feel, you know, you can see why Troma have picked it up. Yeah. It's going to, in the same way, in the same vein that some films have, like, it's not comparable in the sense of, you know, it being the same tone or anything. But in the same way as something like a Serbian film or Human Centipede pick up this kind of following because it builds a reputation. And that's what this is going to do. Well, The Room, for example, is probably a better comparison.
Can we do the quiz now? We spent enough time on this.
Yeah.
You made me watch it, and you can't fucking shut me up about it.
We can, because we know it's dog shit.
Yeah.
Oh, honestly, Owen, I'm so happy you watched that film.
I'm glad someone is, because I'm not.
Mate, a bet's a bet. When you do the quiz, you got to. If you lose, you got to watch the film. You got to do it. No matter what it might be.
I have 2,500 words to write on the use of standard English, right? That's got to be in by Monday.
Okay.
I've written nothing, and I've just spent 1 hour and 18 minutes watching this. I'm
living the dream, mate.
I don't know what I'm doing with my life.
Okay, so the quiz this week, obviously, our main review is Trainspotting 2. And in exchange for you watching Essex Space Bin, I've done the quiz instead.
Yes, that was our trade-off.
It's all about 1996, the quiz. Can I just check? How old were you in 1996?
10.
You were 10? Matt?
Yeah. 13 going on 14.
And Steve?
10th birthday would have been October.
Yeah, mine was August. So we basically spent most of the year 9.
Oh, good. Well, I was 26 and was having a good time. Oh, no. First question. In 1996, who was the UK Prime Minister? Was it Tony Blair, John Major, or Gordon Brown? So, Owen, you can go first.
John Major.
That's what I thought.
I thought so too.
Okay. Point each.
Because didn't Blair start giving it the old Labour's coming home after football's coming home?
Yeah, 97 Labour got in.
Yeah.
Did. That's a nice little warm-up. Thought you'd get that one. Which LP sold the most copies in 1996? Was it Oasis with the What's the Story, Alanis Morissette with Jagged Little Pill, or the Spice Girls with Spice?
Wow.
Steve, Matt?
That's tough, isn't it?
I would have to go for Spice Girls, but they're all massive.
But Oasis, was it UK or global?
No, UK.
I'd say Oasis. They were huge at that time.
Yeah, what Spice Girls were the biggest ever.
So, which one are you going for?
I would personally go for the Spice Girls.
I'm gonna go with Matt then. The Spice Girls.
Yeah, I think it was Spice World. I seem to remember it smashing some record the Beatles had.
Okay, well, it was actually Alanis Morissette with Jagged Little Pill.
No, really?
No points for either of you.
Blimey.
I've got no respect for the British public of 1996 anymore.
Moving on to singles, which of these sold the most copies in 1996? Killing Me Softly by the Fugees, Spaceman by Babylon Zoo, Wannabe by the Spice Girls. Owen?
Well, just sticking with what I just said, I'll say Spice Girls again.
Okay.
Should we twist, Matt? I'm not going Spice Girls. Should we go Fugees?
I was going to say Fugees, yeah, because I seem to remember that being number one for a while.
It is the Fugees. Well done.
No.
Did they both?
Can we make him watch Essex Spaceman again if we win?
You can do whatever you like, fellas. Let's move on to film. How much was the average cinema ticket price in 1996? Matt, Steve? £3.70, £4.70, or £5.70?
They all seem a lot cheaper than I would have gone for. Like, you have a guess on that one, Steve.
£3.70
for you. What do you reckon, Owen?
Yeah, I'm going to say £3.70. I seem to remember paying about £3.70 for a cinema ticket when I was in Finchley, and that was about 10 years ago, so it can't be much higher than that. £3.70.
This isn't that lottery show. Nick Knowles hasn't asked to show you working for an answer.
Yeah.
Just give £3.70.
Well done. Both of you get a point. Worldwide box office. The number one film that year. This isn't the question. Does anyone know what it was?
96.
Titanic?
Toy Story?
Independence Day.
It was Independence Day. But what was the second highest grossing worldwide film? Was it 101 Dalmatians, Twister, or Space Jam? Owen?
Space Jam.
What do you reckon, boys?
I got a feeling it's Space Jam.
Space Jam, yeah.
No, it was Twister.
God, what a crap film as well.
So no points for either of you. Moving on to Trainspotting. Who was originally cast to play Renton? Was it Ewan Bremner, Johnny Lee Miller, or Robert Carlyle? And is this you to answer, Owen?
Yes. I think it's Robert Carlyle. I think because there was this thing about him being miscast, wasn't there?
Okay.
Bigly, yeah.
What do you think, boys? Who was originally supposed to play Renton in Trainspotting?
I've got a feeling that's right.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
You got nothing to lose if, you know, if I'm wrong and you're wrong, you're still ahead, I think, so.
It was Ewan Bremner. He played him on stage in Scotland. I think he was quite miffed that he wasn't cast and had to have his arm twisted to actually go on and play Spud. Last one. Now, back in 96, everyone was off their tits. And I was at Tribal Gathering that year. It's a big annual dance festival. But who headlined? Was it the Chemical Brothers, Black Grape, or Daft Punk? And Matt and Steve, you can go first. Well, who headlined the biggest off-your-head festival of the year? Chemical Brothers, Black Grape, or Daft Punk?
Don't think it was Daft Punk. I think they're too new. They're too new for 96.
Yeah, Black Grape with Sean Ryder off his tits all his life, so that kind of makes sense.
Chemical Brothers seem a bit new for a headline in 96. I reckon a middle one.
Black Grape?
Yeah.
Okay. Black Grape it is.
Yeah, my first instinct was Black Grape as well.
It was Black Grape. But unfortunately, Owen.
Yeah, I've lost.
You skipped one, and Matt, Steve, you're the winners. Well done.
Well, hey. So what are we going to get Owen to watch now?
Travesty, that was travesty.
Nothing yet. Nothing yet. I'll give you the tiebreaker, which I did have, Steve. Yeah. Trainspotting 1, what was its worldwide box office in pounds? Huh. Another guess, Owen?
96 million, just because it's the same year.
Matt, Steve?
We'll take the over, 97.
48.
Yeah.
But on a budget, fuck all. It was still
made for nothing,
good.
Wasn't it?
Shall we just move on to the Screen Actors Guild Awards, which happened in the last week or so, over the weekend, and Winona Ryder was off her face.
That video of her just hilarious, isn't it?
She's chewing her own ear off.
I saw something that said about how she'd gone through every human emotion in 30 seconds.
I don't know what was wrong with her.
Yeah.
But that was, of course, for Stranger Things that won.
And also resulted in a glorious speech, so I hear. I haven't actually...
Oh, it's just someone harping on about politics as well. I just want to hear about his doing films and TV and that.
Yeah.
Using it as his own soapbox to protest at Trump and things that are happening. But yeah, Stranger Things won Best Cast of the TV Drama Series, beating off The Crown and Downton Abbey, Game of Thrones and Westworld.
Good.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because the others sound terrible and I really enjoyed Stranger Things.
Mm-hmm. It was great. But yeah, so basically there was another... because it's the Screen Actors Guild, the SAG Awards, it is mainly about performances as opposed to any of the quality, you know, any quality in the movies and stuff. So were there anything there that kind of jumped out at you guys? Anything that seems...
Well, best male actor in TV comedy series, William H. Macy for Shameless. And I didn't realise the American version of Shameless was so popular.
Neither did I.
I didn't realise it was... that. I would have thought it would be a thing that had done a couple of series and died.
I know. But it seems
to have gone like the American Office.
Seasons? It's been going forever. And I watched I watched the first couple of episodes, and it was pretty bang on to the UK one. It was kind of, but it was weird. It kept pulling me out of it because I couldn't adjust to the Americans doing it.
Hmm. Well, I've only caught bits of Shameless, you know, the odd episode here and there. I never watched it religiously, but it seemed about as British as a show can get. So I was always a bit sceptical about how it would have translated. But clearly, you know, they must be doing something right.
And The Crown picked up a few awards for Best Male Actor for John Lithgow and Best Female Actor for Claire Foy. Not one I've seen. It doesn't appeal to me at all. I thought it would just be like really by the books, paint by numbers, boring TV about the royals. But apparently it's very good and very popular.
It's not very good. I mean, that is an exaggeration of... I mean, I'm only about three episodes in, but I've just sacked it off. It's basically pretty dresses, sets, costumes, and the royals. Oh, what drama! And I don't care about them. I don't care about the story. The characters aren't particularly well written. It's kind of reliant on you knowing who they are and stuff. And I just... Yeah, it's a vanity project as far as I can tell. It's
not for me.
Appealing to the same crowd as Downton Abbey would.
Any Oscar pointers there in the main two categories? The best actor and best actress?
For films, yeah. Well, I don't know if Denzel will do it, I have to admit.
Well, I said to you earlier, I watched most of it last night. It's just Denzel in his garden talking, and he talks a lot. It's like a machine gun going off, and even after I dozed off, just listening to it, it made no difference. You didn't have to actually see what was happening on the screen to kind of understand the film. Mm. But yeah, it was a bit of a chore, to be honest.
Yeah, this is Fences, right? So this is a film that has been adapted from a stage play.
Yeah, and that I didn't know that before, and that makes absolute sense now.
Yeah, yeah,
very weird.
Very dialogue heavy.
Yeah,
But there's a clip they keep showing from it. With him and Viola Davis in the garden, shouting at each other, and she said something like she stood by him all the time. She was right there, or something like that. I've seen that clip so many times now, I feel like I don't need to see the film.
That's pretty much it, because it's just him in his garden.
Yeah, I think I've got it. I think I know. Which is a very obnoxious thing to say, but yeah. It's about 2 hours and 20 minutes or something like that, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't know how far I got, but I fell asleep watching it. And then obviously Emma Stone with La La Land.
Which I'm kind of fine with. I think it's just... I did see Jackie this week, and Natalie Portman was very good in that, in what is a very boring film. you know, I can slag off Essex Spacebin, but at least it's not boring. You know, Jackie was just... I'm fed up of them. I'm fed up of these movies. I'm not going to go on a rant again, but I'm just sick of conventional blueprinted shit, quite frankly.
Do you remember what question I asked everyone around award season last season that stumped everyone?
Go on.
So right, in The Craze,
mm-hmm.
Tom Hardy played two characters.
Oh, yeah.
Could he get a nomination for being really good as Reggie Cray? But if he was really shit at Ronnie Cray, didn't get a nomination for that one, rather than just the film as a whole. Do you get nominated on your, you know, so it's your performance. So if he got nominated for that film, but he was awful as one Cray, amazing at the other one, will he get a nomination for just that one? Or would they just say it's the whole film?
Didn't Phil Sharman come up with an answer to that?
Yeah, and I'm didn't sure he actually, was wrong.
Probably.
He researched it, though, didn't he? He came up with it and said that no.
Did he?
You can
I can't
only...
remember.
I think he could only be nominated for one.
Yeah.
For one character?
No, yeah. For one performance in the film. It's the same person doing the performance in the film. Just because yeah. he's offering more than... It's like if someone is playing exactly. schizophrenic or whatever, it's still that actor delivering a performance in that film.
Exactly. James McAvoy in Split can only be nominated for one.
That's slightly different, though, because he's playing one person with multiple personalities, whereas Tom Hardy played two distinctly separate people.
But it's, as Paul said, he's just it's you're nominated for your performance, not
necessarily
your... Should
we just stop doing
your...
this debate again that got us nowhere
last year? Yeah. Joe did that last year.
Yeah. What, on the subject of performances, what the fuck is Emily Blunt doing in that category for The Girl on the Train? I'm presuming you guys have seen it.
Yes.
Yeah, it wasn't great, was it?
It was a really bad thriller, and she was okay, but I mean, that seems really bottom of the barrel, yeah, trying to find a performance to fill that category
that
with.
That film in general just annoys me, never mind her performance, because it's quite clearly designed to sort of like light a fire inside of scorned women everywhere. Like anyone who's had any bad experience with men just... love shit like that. It proper winds me up.
Why is that?
The book as well, and makes it even worse because it's nothing like the book. You know, it's set in the UK for starters, and I think she goes into like Waterloo every day. I mean, but it's just so far removed from a British bird who's doing that to an American. I don't know why. It just really didn't sit well with me at all.
Mm.
It kept pulling me out of the film. It was awful.
Time now for what we've been watching. We have a look at films we've seen in the last 7 days that aren't going to be featured in the main new release section of the podcast. And Paul, what have you seen?
I've seen a Swedish film which is up for the Best Foreign Oscar called A Man Called Uwe, which is about a miserable, cantankerous old bastard.
Mm.
No idea why I would.
Yeah, this. Why did that appeal to you, Paul?
Well, who knows? He lives in like a shelter, not a sheltered housing complex, but I don't know how to describe it. The newest thing we would have. It's not council, maybe like a council association or something. Mm. And he's on like a committee looking after the paths, the garages, the pathways. He puts all the signs up. It's very regimented. Everything has to be done by the book. If you drop a fag butt, he'll be on your case. His wife passes away. He goes to her grave every day. Things then get worse for him after his wife dies. He loses his job and he thinks, fuck it, I'm going to kill myself. And he tries to kill himself and fails. And you get this recurring theme of him constantly trying to kill himself using various different methods and all of them going tits. Then we get this family who move in next door to him. The mother there of the family is of Iranian descent. Her husband's an idiot and they've got two kids. And it's basically about the impact that this family has upon his life. And I know it sounds kind of maybe a little bit trite and we've seen all this before, but I just found it wonderful. It was really, really, if you had to kind of pick your perfect Sunday afternoon film, this would be it, because it's really funny. It's really heartfelt, very heartwarming. It looks beautiful. It's the acting is just off the hook, and I can see why it's up for the Oscar. And I just absolutely loved it. Absolutely loved it. And it's quite long, but then it's worthwhile investing the time. You get these flashbacks. So, for example, we know his wife's dead. We get to see how that happened. When people come to his house, you see the kitchen's been lowered. And he says, oh, that's for my wife. We flash back to find out, you know, how and why that kitchen was lowered. They don't have any kids. We find out why that happened. And it works really, really well. The flashbacks are not there to kind of pad out the timing. It's really engaging and really interesting to find out all the kind of pieces of his life as they fit together in a jigsaw. And then you overlay his current situation, all the people around him, And it's, yeah, amazing. I can't recommend it enough. One of the best films I've seen this year.
Okay. Owen, what have you seen?
I watched a film called Sadako versus Kayako, and I'm probably pronouncing those incorrectly. Basically, it's The Ring versus The Grudge, which I mentioned at the end of the podcast last week as a recommendation, because I hadn't seen it yet, but it had just been added to Shudder, the horror film streaming service. So for those who don't know, Sadako is the demon from The Ring, or Ringu, and Kayako is the demon girl from Ju-on, The Grudge. It also features Toshio, who I think I probably more associate with The Grudge, which is the little sort of grey-blue boy who has the dry lips that he licks and is just a bit creepy and weird, right? It has all of those in there, and the sort of premise of the film is they're going to have a fight. So, just before I move on to explain the film a little bit more, in terms of J-horror, these Japanese horror films, presumably, I know, Paul, you're a big fan. Matt, I know you were working in cinemas around the time. Is your... What's your view on J-horror?
I kind of liked them at the time from the perspective of there was this wave of foreign cinema that was really infiltrating mm-hmm. the UK, whether it's through independent cinema or the sort of DVD import market, which is less and less prevalent these days with streaming and Blu-ray. But there was a massive sort of scene for it. And so people were watching a lot of movies back in the sort of late 90s that they wouldn't have normally tapped into, and stuff like The Ring and The Grudge and whatnot were definitely mm-hmm. high amongst those. So it was actually quite an exciting sort of movement in cinema. Yes. Mm-hmm. I think we're kind of past it a little bit now. I mean, I'm still a fan of foreign cinema in general, but I think I'm probably gone more mainstream in the fact that I'm quite prepared to wait for the American remake, which is almost inevitable of any decent Asian movie that comes out these days. So I haven't seen a new one in quite a long time.
Yeah, but things like Dark Water and, you know, I guess Battle Royale can kind of come into it a little bit. With those, that craze of an Audition, maybe some of the Takeshi Mike films.
And good examples. Yeah.
So, Paul, you're probably a bigger fan of horror films than me, even, and particularly sort of Asian movies.
Mm-hmm.
And J horror, does it do anything for you?
It did. I mean, all of anything with a girl with long black hair appearing mm-hmm. either out the telly, round the corner, out the wall. But that kind of shtick has been beaten to death. So I'm really curious to see how they're dealing with it in 2016, and if that's still the same shtick.
Okay, right. Well, I missed the early craze in the sort of noughties. I only got into some of these films a bit later on. In fact, I think I saw The Ring remake before I saw Ringu. And The Grudge as well, for example. I saw that even after I'd seen Ringu. And I didn't particularly think it was a good film. I thought it was scary and it had atmosphere, but it's not a great story. There's not so much plot. But then the point of it wasn't to do that. So anyway, yeah, so I came to these late, but I had I kind of liked them. But even now, you know, I only saw them like 5-6 years ago. Even now, I'm a bit bored of them. And so, yeah, I went into this hoping it would be, or expecting even, a camp kind of Freddy versus Jason-esque horror comedy, which it so nearly is. But I don't think it quite achieves that. And I know that we slag off as well Lionsgate and all those, you know, New Line Cinema, all those by-the-numbers horrors that...
PG-13 horrors by accountants.
PG, exactly. You said it, exactly. Those, I know we slag those off, but at least they often have a sense of direction and storytelling as part of it. Whether it's basic and it's just a repetition of stuff that's been before is another matter. This doesn't really have that. It's kind of like a meandering amalgamation of two weak horror films. One about a girl who accidentally watches a cursed videotape, and one about a girl whose family move into the house opposite a haunted house where people die when they enter. Neither of which are very good. They're not particularly well told. They're not really that interesting. They're kind of choppy, a bit bloated even, which is weird when you think it's like a film that's about an hour and a half. And there's two of these stories going on at the same time. There's an awful lot of nothing. And there's an awful lot of dialogue that just doesn't contribute anything. Not in terms of character, not in terms of atmosphere, not in terms of story progression, nothing. It's just a bit weird. And so it doesn't really work particularly well. And it would have benefited from perhaps a stronger producer who was involved with it. And I think as well that what shows is that it's a prime example of marketing trumping the product, if you'll excuse my use of the word trumping there, given the current political climate. But what I mean, literally mean is that, like, this film, one of the things that happened with Sadako versus Kayako is they did a deal with Hello Kitty to make some merchandise. Hello Kitty and The Ring and the Grudge.
Yeah. Couldn't be more late 90s, could you?
Exactly. Yeah, perhaps not. But also, what happened with this, which is an interesting story, which I didn't realise until after I'd watched the film, but makes complete sense now, is the original trailer was released on the 1st of April as an April Fool's joke. Right? It wasn't really going to be a thing, but then the reaction to it was so positive and so strong that by the time December came around, they were like, yeah, fuck it, we're making this movie now. People clearly want to see The Ring versus The Grudge, so we'll just give them that. And so there's barely any effort like been made into turning it into a good film, because it's not good, it is bad. And there's no like intentional humour so far as I could see. Not at least nothing like Freddy versus Jason. Although there is one death scene which did remind me of Nightmare on Elm Street, the sequels, like Dream Warriors or something. As you see, like, one guy is headbutted by an exorcist who's possessed. And, like, for a split second on screen, you see his, like, giant swollen face as he just plummets to the floor. And that really looked like it was done as a humorous nod to Freddy versus Jason, right? Which is kind of cool, I guess. There is another problem, actually, that reminded me of. There's hardly any death scenes on screen, right? And that's the problem with a film like this, you know? You're meant to see two demented demons battling each other, trying to be the one who can possess and kill this girl. But just so much of it happens off screen. And then the finale to it is a massive letdown. They just didn't commit. And I guess I wasn't really expecting them to say, well, this one wins and this one's better than the other. But I don't know. It just kind of petered out. And I was a little bit disappointed. That said, it's watchable. It's weirdly watchable. Because you just want to see the
fight. Yeah,
they're
going to put that on the poster.
Yeah. No, watchable. It's watchable because you want... They've got you. The hook is they're going to have these two things fight. And they do tease them. And they do tease a fight that's brewing. And as cliched as it is, as full of like the most basic tropes they could scramble together into this film, you do want to see its conclusion, so it keeps you going. But it's just I wouldn't subscribe to Shudder. I wouldn't pay the subscription to Shudder just to see it, put it that way.
Okay. This week I saw a film called Hidden Figures, and to do so I flew to America.
Honest. You were sent a copy of the screener from the Academy?
No, I flew to America.
Right, okay.
Because of its UK release date, it's not going to be out in time, probably for us to give it a decent review ahead of the Oscar preview or Oscar review special.
How did you get past Homeland Security? I thought you had a Somalian passport.
Well, yeah. I tunnelled under the wall. like Escape to Victory, which I actually watched this week on Sunday while I was at work, cause it was on. Someone tunneled into the changing rooms and got me in.
Nice.
Or did out. You see the Sunday Sport thing about the wall?
No.
That Mexican prostitutes are going to drill glory holes in the wall.
It's a novel approach.
God, I can't wait to see that gag on film.
Yes, it's going to happen.
It's going to happen. You know it.
Yes, I saw Hidden Figures, which was a film about three African-American mathematicians at NASA in the 60s, and them trying to obviously forge their way in NASA and trying to get the roles they want, the jobs they want, the education they want, while being both women and African-American, while obviously being in a segregated society at the time, and going for jobs that at the time certainly weren't for African-American people, certainly weren't for females either. So they kind of hamstrung on three counts. They're based on true stories as well, starring some other than Kevin Costner, who was kind of playing the head of NASA, Kirsten Dunst, who was just kind of a supporting role, and Jim Parsons, a supporting role. Three actresses that I didn't really know anything about. Taraji P. Henson, who I think is in Empire, probably best known for Empire, the show that's on E4.
Mm-hmm.
And then Octavia Spencer and Janelle Monáe. I probably butchered those pronunciations. No, it's fantastic. I thought the three central performances of the women were fantastic. I mean, Kevin Costner was good in a very, very much minor supporting role, but just kind of good as he has been in films lately. But the three main women who are going about trying to make their way, trying to prove their worth, trying to get around obstacles put in their way, which just seem extremely... When you're looking at it from now, it just seems completely ridiculous, and you can't even imagine what it would be like to live through something like that. You know, even as a white male, sort of experience where people are being physically segregated from other people just because of their colour. Mm. I mean, Paul probably lived through it, so...
No, we just segregate people by age. Yeah,
like Paul. But no, so yeah, it's really interesting. Plus, it features the space race, which is something that I love anyway. I love space and NASA and astronauts and all that kind of thing. So that playing into it probably gave the story a added layer of interest. Where it was a more boring job they were going for, perhaps wouldn't have held as much interest. Does that make sense?
Mm.
If they weren't trying to get a job in NASA, they were trying to get a job in something as important as NASA, but not as interesting, then the film might not have held as much interest to me, but that's by the by, really. Yeah, like I said, it's based on a true story, so doing the maths for John Glenn's first space flight, and he actually wanted... what's her name? Johnson, Catherine Johnson is the one played by Taraji P. Henson. He actually wanted her to verify the maths for his space launch. He wouldn't have done it without her doing it.
Mm.
I definitely recommend everyone watch it before the. I could see it picking up perhaps a best supporting actress Oscar for someone maybe, but it's going to be tough against some of the other films. I don't think it's going to trouble best film or best actor or actress. Certainly won't trouble best actor, but it's definitely worth a watch. It's definitely better than some of the other biopics that are out ahead of around Oscar season.
Cool, I've got it to watch, Steve. Now you've said that, I'm definitely going to give it a poke.
Oh, don't listen to my recommendations. I don't know what I'm talking
about.
Wait,
if it's engaged you, no, that means in a nasty way. That means if I'm all in. Because normally these Oscar films can be quite boring.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's not. It's not boring.
Saying,
it's not boring in the slightest.
Exactly. So now you've said all that, I'm genuinely quite happy to watch it.
Matt, what have you seen this week?
Yeah, so like you, I've been sort of flying around the world watching movies as well. I took a jet over to Japan to see Shin Godzilla, or more commonly referred to as Godzilla Resurgence in the West.
Matt, did you pick up that box of Japanese monkey porn for me?
I did. I'll put it in the post for you right away, mate.
Cheers, fella.
You got a pack of used girls' knickers out of the vending machine.
Jesus Christ. I'm not a sex tourist.
That's some lunch, that is.
It is, but this is commitment to the cause.
And I'm a big Godzilla fan. Used panties.
Yeah, I was getting sick of waiting for it to come out over here and see it in a local cinema, which was unfortunately never going to happen. But yeah, for those who aren't aware, it's the 31st Godzilla movie out of the whole Japanese and American go at the series. And it's co-directed by Hideki Anno and Shinji Higuchi, who are the creative forces behind the popular anime and comic Neon Genesis Evangelion, which I'm sure a few of our listeners will have heard of or perhaps seen before.
Evangelion, I think.
Is that how you pronounce it?
I think so, yeah.
Okay. Evangelion. So that might give you a slight idea of where the tone of the movie is heading, because they are quite weird and wonderful in that series. So it's not just going to be your traditional sort of Godzilla stomp-a-thon as he just smashes up the city, although you do get quite a bit of that. It gets a little bit more sophisticated than that. So the premise of the story, kind of similar in tone to the very first Godzilla film, which is a take on the mental state of Japan following the American atom bombs at the end of the Second World War. This kind of takes over from the Fukushima nuclear accidents in the, it was about 5 or 6 years ago now.
Mm.
It seems like such a long time ago, but it's not in reality. And a country sort of recovering from the sort of paranoia of that disaster and their coexistence and reliance on nuclear energy to survive in their everyday life. And where this film really differs from traditional Godzilla movies is it casts all of those aside as if they hadn't happened. So this is like almost a brand new reboot, retelling, reimagining of the whole Godzilla thing. And the city comes under attack, and we're referring to Tokyo here, of course, by a monster which is enormous and scary, but is nothing like what you might imagine Godzilla to be like in your head. And I'm not going to spoil it too much, but what he starts off as and what he ends up being are very different. There's a sort of evolution of the monster as the film goes along before he eventually becomes this all-powerful and destructive force, where he can essentially evolve to fight the threat of any type of attack that humanity can pose against it and do it quite rapidly. So it almost seems indestructible, but as they always do, they eventually find a way to fell the beast somehow, however unrealistic that might be. Although the science behind it's quite interesting and it's somewhat plausible, but you wouldn't expect this particular monster to go down in the way that it does, put it that way. But one of the problems with Godzilla films in general, and I've seen most of them, is that everyone is there to see the monster. And any scene that doesn't contain the monster is usually drab, disappointing, and boring. And they have to put a lot of those in to sort of pad out a Godzilla movie. You know, they tend to be 90 minutes to 2 hours long, and you might only get 15, 20 minutes of the monster. So everything in between is usually pretty boring. This film does a much better job of that. I'm not saying it's perfect by any means, but the whole political spectrum that surrounds the movie, and it kind of focuses on the incompetence of the Japanese government and the various authorities in, oh, Godzilla's attacking this part of the city, whose legislation does it fall under and who needs to sign off before we can do anything? And by the time they get around to making a decision, it's too late. Bad shit's already happened and something's been destroyed and loads of people have been killed. So they're kind of paralyzed by bureaucracy. Right up until the end, when they all start to eventually sort of team together and find a solution. But that's when it's kind of taken out of their hands by foreign powers, let's say, who are more concerned about what might go on once it's destroyed Japan. Erwin, I think you've had a look at this as well, and the political sort of element of this, it is a little bit interesting, a little bit quirky. And it does sort of set it aside from other Godzilla movies, I think. What did you think about it?
I Oh, man. So, like, it's interesting you mentioned about the bureaucracy, because the thing I thought about it as I was watching it is it was very Kafkaesque. You know, it's all very much about the bureaucracy, about people sitting around in boardrooms trying to decide what to do whilst a raging monster comes along and topples the buildings in their capital city. It's kind of... that's... I think I said in a review that it's basically like if Kafka wrote the screenplay and then directed it on speed, because you have like the juxtaposition of this slow process that's held back by ticker tape and, you know, waiting on signatures, against the direction, like the actual aesthetic of it, because it's I read that the director, I can't remember his name off the top of my head. I read that what he basically wanted was for everybody to speak super quickly. Everyone had to keep talking like this. If they started talking slowly, then he was going to cut them completely from the film and they wouldn't be in it at all. So everyone has to talk very fast. So even though it's full of lots of dialogue, which is tedious, it kind of wants to get through it quite quickly. So it wants to show you this slow, boring process, but not actually spend any time on it. Which is kind of an interesting way for it to pan out. Because it is a monster movie, ultimately. And it is a Godzilla movie. And the Godzilla fans, I assume, you know, this is me making assumptions, will presumably want Godzilla in it. So they want to see the kind of destruction and the fallout. And, you know, the eventual, not necessarily heroics, but saving the day kind of thing. Do you know what I mean? I think it's a film that can be enjoyed by anyone who suffers from ADD, basically. If you've got attention deficit disorder, doesn't matter, because everything you need to know is sped up. It's like watching a film at 2x speed.
Yeah, I would agree with that. It is kind of paced quite well, despite having a ton of dialogue in it,
yeah,
which traditional Godzilla movies suffer from in a bad way. But I think what they're trying to get at there is that the ineptitude of government when things go wrong is almost as terrifying as the monster itself.
Yeah.
I mean, they can't get anything done, basically, which dooms us all.
It's basically, it shows as well, like, the Godzilla creature is evolving at each stage. It evolves quicker than they can do anything about it. So it's like, it's like a reflection on the fact that they're just basically sitting around chatting, and as in the time it takes for them to make a decision, it's changed. The situation's evolved, and it's bigger and stronger and worse. And so I think it's quite clever. I mean, I like it in concept. I like the film in concept, but I mean, it's a weird comparison, but it was like Hardcore Henry for me, in that both films made me feel dizzy. In very different ways. Like Hardcore Henry, I just couldn't keep my eyes focused on it because it was like watching a third-person action shooter thing, whereas this was just so fast. It was so quick. I was all over the place.
It's a little bit discombobulating. And
yeah, it's a good word
for
it.
To be fairness, in terms of how you would sort of rate this movie, a Godzilla can never be a 10 out of 10 film just based on what it is. And
The original is very close to it. The original's a fantastic anti-war movie.
Yes, I would agree with that. It is a classic. The rest of them can't sort of reach that emotional high note of that one, because once it's been done, it's been done. So you can't rate Shin Godzilla amongst all-time great movies at all, but within the Godzilla universe, it's a very, very strong entry. And if you are remotely a fan of Godzilla, or let's say the American one from a couple of years ago left a bad taste in your mouth, I think you would enjoy this one a lot more. And I think it's probably created an issue now for whoever it is who's behind the American one. I can't remember the name of the company who did it now. But yeah. Now that there's a Western audience for this latest Japanese incarnate of Godzilla, the expectations now are going to be very different and a lot higher for these Godzilla sequels that are coming out over the next 4 or 5 years. So they're going to have a bit of a hurdle to get over with that. The expectations now are much higher than they would have been just off the back of that last Godzilla movie. But I really like it. If you get a chance to see it, try and check it out.
Where do American versions of Godzilla stand in Japanese cinema, Godzilla's canon?
They hate them, don't they?
They despise them. The name of this one, Shin Godzilla, the Shin refers to loosely as real or ultimate Godzilla, basically almost dismissing the last American one out of hand. They find that the American take on it is much more less traditional, even though I think the last one did a much better job than the one from the mid-90s.
I like the one with Matthew Broderick in it.
No, you don't.
You didn't.
Yeah, dude. Ferris Bueller and Godzilla was awesome.
No. There was a film in the early 2000s, which was the last Japanese Godzilla before this one, called Godzilla Final Wars, where they basically had Godzilla square off against all the monsters in the Godzilla universe, plus the creature called Zilla, which is what they referred to as the American Godzilla. So they won't call it Godzilla because they think it's an inferior monster, so they just called it Zilla. They have a big showdown near the Sydney Opera House and Godzilla just destroys it within seconds, just makes it totally irrelevant. So they put it into canon and then destroyed it. So that's what they think of it.
Isn't there a weird thing about, like, its name is actually Gojira? And that's not like someone doing a dodgy Japanese accent, but it was like an amalgamation of two things, wasn't it? It was like, yeah, God and
something to do with like God incarnate and
yeah,
something.
Yeah.
So that's what it is referred to in Japan as Gojira.
Yeah. So basically, by calling it Zilla, it's even more of an insult, isn't it? It's a dismissive, yeah. Like they don't get it.
Precisely. It's just a total afterthought as far as they're concerned. They're not interested. And there's not a lot that's traditional Godzilla about that movie. That was just a generic monster movie with a Godzilla brand on it. And, you know, did the box office, but it was so bad it was never going to get a sequel. So, but then eventually it kind of did.
Mm.
In our new release section this week, we are going to review Trainspotting 2, or T2 Trainspotting, the sequel, obviously, to Trainspotting, starring...
could be the sequel to Terminator 2. Terminator 2 Trainspotting.
Well, that'd be a completely different film. I Begbie could very well be a Terminator.
He's not far off it.
Next person to do a Terminator joke about T2 is first up against the wall.
But yes, it brings back Renton, Sick Boy, Spud and Begbie 20 years on from the events of the first film, after Renton nicked all the money off him and skipped the country. Paul, as our resident Irving Welsh Trainspotting expert fan, this isn't a version of the sequel to the book, or the book sequel of Porno, is it?
No, it's not. And do you know what? Should we get that out of the way first?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
I mean, I love Irving Welsh. I think on the podcast recently, I said I met him recently. Lovely bloke. Talks about the Blade Artist. And that kind of leads into the whole Trainspotting universe in the literary sense. You've got sort of Glue, Trainspotting, Skag Boys, Porno, A Decent Ride, and most recently, the Blade Artist. And within that literary universe, it's very, very different now to what's been delivered in the cinematic universe. To give a little bit of history here, back in 2009, Danny Boyle first said that he wanted to do this film, and it was going to be set sort of 10 years after. He was going to base it on Porno. Then there was 4 years of silence, and 2013, Danny Boyle came out and said he wanted to do this film based on Porno. 2014, it took until Ewan McGregor and Danny Boyle made up after their falling out over the beach. Then it took to 2015 before they'd actually confirmed they were going to do it. Then 2016, it was filmed. And finally, now in 2017, it was released. But the problem is, Danny Boyle's original statements about everything being based on Porno, that's set 10 years after Trainspotting. But we're now 20 years on. And not to put a damper on things, but I just wanted to read you the synopsis. I've got my like first edition Porno book here from 2002, and I'm going to read this to you and see, you can see immediately the difference between what that's about and what the film's about. In the fag end of his youth, Simon Sick Boy Williamson is back in his native Edinburgh after a long spell in London. Having failed spectacularly as a hustler, pimp, husband, father and businessman, Sick Boy taps into an opportunity which to him represents one last row of the dice. To enable this scam to work out, Sick Boy needs bedfellows. A desirable one may be the lovely Nikki Fuller Smith, a young student with enough ambition and ego and troubles to rival his own. However, to realise his dream of directing and producing a pornographic movie, Sick Boy gets teamed up with his old pal and fellow exile Mark Renton and a motley crew that includes the city's favourite ex-aerated water salesman, Juice Terry Lawson. In the world of porno, however, nothing is straightforward. As Sick Boy and Renton find out that they have unresolved issues to address concerning the increasingly unhinged Frank Begbie, the troubled drug-addled Spud, and most of all with each other. I mean, that's not what this is about, is it? Not in any way, shape or form. Mm-hmm. So you really need to divorce the kind of the books from the films now, which I'm fine with, but for huge kind of fans of his work, it's a huge kind of hurdle to get over.
But isn't Danny Boyle on record as saying he doesn't like porno?
He is, yeah.
So, I mean, it kind of makes sense then that he's waiting till the right time to do Trainspotting 2, because it'll be enough time where he can distance himself from the book sequel and just write whatever movie or adapt whatever bits of that book that he wants to adapt.
I think he doesn't like it because, well, we had Escobar Walker on last time. Yeah. Porno is very reminiscent of stuff that Escobar Walker writes. It's absolutely filthy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, completely and utterly off the hook, insane, the stuff that goes on in that book. And just, but even in the back of my mind, all I can think about is, oh, why didn't they do that? You know, why didn't they have this character in? But, you know, once I kind of sat down and I knew, and I just literally had to kind of try and wipe all that stuff from my mind and just go with what they were going to present. And I still loved it.
Yeah, I mean, I loved it as well. I really thought this is the film of the year so far. And it surprised me, actually, because, I mean, I am a huge fan of Danny Boyle's previous stuff. I think I saw Trainspotting when I was probably a bit too young, you know. I think I saw it when it came out on video initially. So whenever that would have been, 97, 98, something like that. And I would have been, what, 12, 13? I was terrified of it. You know, the baby crawling along the ceiling and all the weird trippy bits just completely freaked me out. But I probably didn't get it. So I rewatched it this week last week for the first time since then. It's a brilliant movie. I get it. I see why people love it so much. But I think watching them so close together also really works because you don't need the time apart from them. They're very much connected. And I don't think it necessarily needed to be a completely different story. What Trainspotting 2 is about dealing with time and distance from the previous film. So you don't need to actually live that time and distance. It works. It's almost like they made it the next, like, a year later. Do you know what I mean? Is that making sense? It doesn't matter that the actual physical time between them is so great.
Yeah,
It could have been made a year later. It could have been set a year later. It's about dealing with that
form. Yeah, I mean, I was 26 at the time, and it was, you know, it was almost like a defining piece of art for me. It captured everything of all my experiences of the time, obviously, apart from the heroin, but, the friendships, the isolation, the rebellion, the self-destruction, and then moving forward 20 years, you know, the disappointment, regret, and wondering what the fuck have you been up to for the last 20 years? It really resonated with me. It was really powerful then and really powerful now.
There is definitely that aspect to it. Like, they make no bones about it. They don't... I mean, they don't look back at the heroin stuff with rose-tinted glasses. What they look back on is the camaraderie, the friendship and the relationships that they had and then lost.
Mm.
And I think that's very different to them looking back at doing all the drugs and what a blast that was. Because the films, I mean, even Trainspotting's more, it's about more than just some people shooting heroin.
Of course it is. It's all about friendship. That's, you know, exactly. that's absolutely its core value.
It's like, I mean, I guess it's very obnoxious again of me. I'll be very obnoxious on the podcast today, but it's like how we have film as the common language that we talk about on the podcast.
Mm.
It doesn't matter. We're just mates who get together and chat. Film just happens to be the thing we chat about because that's why we're here. But in Trainspotting, heroin is the common language.
Yeah, it's back in 96 when, you know, the people I was with, it was all about, you know, going to these big raves and getting off your fucking nut.
Yeah, exactly.
But it was all, yeah, there was a common kind of glue that binded us.
Exactly, yeah. Whereas it's the relationships that were then forged anyway, or, you know, this one goes even further back, doesn't it? Because you don't really get in Trainspotting much about them as kids. This one shows actually Sick Boy and Renton, they've been mates forever. Yeah. They've been together as pals. And I don't know, I quite like that about it. It looks further back than just the original. I just thought it was a really bloody good film. And also, fucking funny. I just laughed my ass off at some of it.
Well, Trainspotting is probably one of the funniest films ever made. And this is, you know, not quite as funny, but it's up there. They are both. I always look at them as comedies, sort of comedy dramas.
They're very gross comedies. Not gross as in, like, you know, American frat boy gross, but as gross as in the way that you're looking at humanity sometimes through them.
But when you ask people their favourite comedies, nobody's going to say Trainspotting. No, I do.
It's dark. It's dark. And I think this one isn't as dark. It's very much more of an introspective examination of the characters and the lives that they've had. But it's still funny. It's just
Come on, let's bring the others in here. I want to see what...
Yeah, I'm going on. Sorry.
Oh, God, here we go. Yeah, I don't like it nearly as much as you two do. I did enjoy it. But I've got bones to pick with it. I really love Trainspotting and watched it again at the weekend before we went and saw this. And it's still as impactful as it was back then. And it's even though they were using older music sometimes in Trainspotting, the 20 years that's passed has made it even more cool. So when you're trying to live up to that, it's very difficult, I think. But one thing that immediately sprung to mind as I was watching this, and I was thinking it as I was watching it, it's not something that I've necessarily considered after the fact, but when you have such a large gap between a first iteration and a later one, I think they found it difficult personally to recapture their presence of mind in those characters. They didn't feel authentic enough to me. Give you an example of what I'm talking about, because I'm sure you'll probably disagree in regards to Trainspotting, because you obviously really enjoyed it. But I used to be a big fan of Bottom, you know, of Rip Mayall and Adrian Edmondson. And they did the TV show, then they did a couple of live shows, and they went away for a few years, and Rip Mayall nearly killed himself on a quad bike. And then when he came back, after so many years, they were still funny, but the characters were lost. It wasn't ever quite the same. And I didn't feel like I was watching Renton and Sick Boy and particularly Begbie. He seemed like an absolute caricature of himself, nowhere near as terrifying, even though he had more reason to be angry than ever.
I think 20 years has passed. I totally believed I was watching those four characters. Just 20 years. 20 years is a long time.
It is.
That's a lot of life experiences under their belt. They will have changed.
Let me expand on that a little bit.
Go on then. Stuff.
I thought, and maybe this was just me, but I thought that Johnny Lee Miller's accent was completely different than it was in Trainspotting. Didn't sound quite the same to me at all.
Are you sure you're not thinking back to him doing James Bond when he does his Connery accent?
Yeah. It didn't sound quite right to me. And obviously, if you haven't done a Scottish accent for that one, then fair enough, you might lose the exact tone that you had, but it didn't seem quite the same. And the other thing was, when I watched Trainspotting, you know, as a teenager, when it first came out, I knew nothing about Ewan McGregor. I knew nothing about Johnny Lee Miller, Ewan Bremner, or Robert Carlyle. Now, Ewan McGregor's Obi-Wan Kenobi. Johnny Lee Miller is Sherlock. And I found it very difficult to get that out of my head as I was watching them on here, because I took them at face value in the first film because I knew nothing about the people portraying those roles. Now, I'm very much in my head that they are these characters now, because that's what they've done more recently and for a prolonged period of time. So I thought Ewan McGregor was playing himself. Johnny Lee Miller was something else completely, although I enjoyed his performance in general. He didn't seem quite like the same character to me. So I found it difficult to sort of get into. And like I said, I was most disappointed with Begbie. He seems to be the butt of a lot of jokes in this and the source of a lot of comedy. Whereas in Trainspotting, he's just pure terror. They are so shit scared of him, and you as an audience feel shit scared of him as well, because we all know someone who can go off like that. Whereas in this, yeah, they're scared of him, but they're kind of laughing at him at the same time, and we're supposed to laugh at him rather than be scared of him. And I didn't like that. Didn't work for me.
There was no, like, they put that into the film, though, I think. I think they're very much aware of what's going on. And there's a bit where that him and Spud are together, right? And that they are reminiscing about a certain thing that happened in the first film. I'm trying not to be too specific here for anyone who hasn't seen the film yet.
Not much of a spoiler, is it? You can say that you know, they're reminiscing about throwing a glass over.
Yeah, okay, fine.
It's not really a spoiler. Fair.
No, I know, but there's, like, it's a crucial moment in the film. In terms of, well, I think it is in terms of the relationship between them. And it, anyway, so basically that happens and they're reminiscing about it. I think in that moment, you see that he's not, that Franco isn't the same. And it's a very clever device of showing you him old and then showing, showing him young and then showing him older and more, at odds with the world. Whereas before he was part of it, and now he's outside and he's looking back at these things that happened. And he's thinking, oh yeah, what a fucking great guy that old Begbie was. When he, it's like, it's a separation. It's a separation of the old Begbie and the new. I think that worked quite well. I take your point about some of the performances. I thought he wasn't as terrifying as Begbie this time. In the original Trainspotting, Robert Carlyle was just fucking nuts.
It's worth pointing out that in The Blade Artist, which follows this,
yeah,
Begbie lives in California, is a recognised artist, and is married with kids.
Right.
I know that seems a bit of a leap.
Yeah.
So just, well, you know, glad so that maybe that may well kind of temper.
Yeah. I did think what was weird about his story, though, was the how the police barely pursued him, you know, broke out of prison, and that was it. There wasn't any.
In the book, he doesn't break out of prison. Yeah. I did find that odd.
But he did in the film, is the thing. He did in the film, yeah. I mean, because he gets himself shivved on purpose, and it goes too far, and he's thinking, yeah, it's okay. It's kind of funny now, and it's not meant to be dark.
I genuinely didn't understand the motivation behind that, because he could have just been up for release.
Yeah.
Do you not see? There was no payoff for him escaping, was there?
There was only because of how it means that he can interact with other characters.
Yeah, I guess so.
You know, if he was just free, everyone would know he was free and everyone else would behave differently. So I think it adds a little bit of something to the relationships. I did think McGregor really got back into the role. I think that's the first time I've seen him for a while where I've not thought of him as Ewan McGregor, and I've thought of him as Renton.
I didn't. I thought I was watching Ewan McGregor, unfortunately, but that was just me.
Oh. Although it had that Choose Life monologue again.
Yeah, that was a bit cringe.
It was a bit tacky. Yeah. It was a bit tacky.
But the whole film, as good as it may or may not have been, it was to Trainspotting what Force Awakens was to New Hope.
No,
it was. It laid on the nostalgia and the references quite heavy.
Yes.
Yeah, but right, like, Steve. But like, Star Wars and Creed and all those things, they retread the nostalgia. I think the nostalgia was a crucial part of this. You know, it was the characters were experiencing nostalgia, and so it was just replicating or reflecting the story.
Yeah, I mean, the
process.
I think one of the issues here is if you were a brand new viewer, if you were, you know, my lad or whatever, and you were seeing this and you had no experience of Trainspotting, you'd be coming out of the cinema going, what the fuck was that rubbish? And I'm so glad it's like they made this film for me. It was so many callbacks, so much nostalgia. Let's be honest, the plot and the story, it was pretty ropey. But I just wanted all these little vignettes of those four idiots interacting in different ways. You know, the bit where they go to the club and you've got all the sectarian stuff going on.
Oh my god.
Yeah, that was genuinely laugh out loud funny.
Fucking hilarious.
Yeah.
And I thought, this, how would, but Think about it. How would that play to a 19-year-old kid going in to watch that film for the first time with no Trainspotting background? It would make no fucking sense at all. They wouldn't understand what was going on. They wouldn't have not a clue.
Yeah, I'm so glad I rewatched it before I went to see it. I sort of tried to squeeze it in on a weekday evening and just managed to get it in. And I was so pleased because I think I would have missed so much watching it watching T2 without that context to a lot of what happened.
Mm. I mean, other than Spud, they're all pretty despicable characters, aren't they?
Well, I mean...
Sick Boy's a... So, 20 years on, Sick Boy was a horrendous human being to start with, and now he's a sort of blackmailing sex pest coke addict. Spud is still Spud. Renton's probably the most normalised one, where he's been away.
He's the most normal one, but he's still a bit of an arse.
Oh yeah,
but he's not normal though. I mean, he's hyper realistic. His whole character is just he's bored with everything, and he thinks he's better than everyone. So I mean,
yeah, but how long did it take for him to be in his old haunt to slip into his old ways?
Precisely. It's not like the normal human who you relate with, I don't think. I don't think any of them you relate to, do you?
I think you're supposed to relate to Renton.
I think you are. I mean, if you had to, it's a good question here for the three of you. If you had to relate to one of the characters, which one would it be for you?
Yeah, you'd be Renton, obviously. You wouldn't think twice about nicking.
Oh, really? I'd be Sick Boy.
definitely. Yeah, I don't know.
Well, you don't want to be, no one wants to be Spud, and you've got to be a complete maniac to be Begbie. So you're left with your morality dictates you fall to Sick Boy or Renton. And Renton's the grounded one who didn't mind fucking over his mates for a score because they're all vile. So he had morality on his side for that. And Sick Boy's just been doing it all his life. So which one are you?
Sick Boy knows a lot about James Bond.
Yeah, not me then. I'm probably Tommy, aren't I?
Yeah, you're dead from toxoplasmosis.
Yeah. What did everyone think of the use of like music and stuff in the film? Because obviously that was a big part of the first one, and I think they do really well in this again, particularly that Prodigy remix of Lust for Life. When it appears, is just very well done.
But I loved how it dropped in the Iggy Pop's Lust for Life as well. How the ending to the film sort of comes
about. He drops that. He puts the record down. And
yeah. Oh, that was brilliant.
I actually had a vinyl delivered today of Underworld called the Slow Slippy, something like that.
Yeah, they do it like half speed or something, don't they?
Mate, I listened to the whole thing, and the other side is the music where Spud's writing his suicide note.
Mm.
And I bought it from the Underworld shop. It literally arrived today, and it is Born Slippy at half speed for 12 minutes.
Yeah,
it's really weird.
Did you notice near the beginning in particular, though, I think it pops up a few times later on as well, a very strange use of pausing, like freeze framing?
Yeah, I saw that. It seemed to be in the first third.
Yeah,
especially during that fight.
Yeah, that was
my favourite scene. I think the bar fight, that was the most Danny Boyle moment, where you're seeing them through like a half empty pint glass, in the background scrapping away. That was just brilliant. That whole scene was just fantastic, and the way that he just goes, "Oh fuck's sake," as he's walking off at the end, I absolutely adored that bit.
It was good. It was. I mean, the things. Spud being sick was right at the start.
Ugh.
It was amazing. Franco taking his kid on that robbery was absolutely hysterical. And Spud doing his stories. I thought that was really, really touching. And we've already mentioned it, but the sectarian song was just fucking. I just thought that was out of this world. Yeah.
Everyone in my cinema was absolutely howling in that one,
singing along and.
Yeah. It was like the thing from Borat, wasn't it? Throw the tube down the well.
That was exactly what I was thinking.
Yeah,
it's I think in terms of just to mention about how Spud is now a writer, they tee that up quite nicely, and it kind of fits really well. But it does seem a little melodramatic at points. I think it was a bit overwrought. Like, there's like how his relationship with the woman who I can't remember the name of. The...
Oh, his girlfriend? You mean Shirley Henderson's Gail?
No, no. The European one.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. Because yeah, I know you mean Veronica.
Veronica, thank you. Yeah, and how, you know, it ends up with him slipping the note under the door, and I thought,
Can we talk about the people outside of the main four? Because there wasn't a huge amount of work for people to do, and as I predicted, Kelly MacDonald was only going to be a cameo.
That was disappointing. I really liked the Diane character. She was a mature head on young shoulders and quite very cool in the first one. This, she just seems like a bit of a smarmy bitch. But yeah, she did drop that nice joke in her last scene, which was quite nice.
Yeah.
I didn't want to be that guy. I don't want to keep going back to the book, but have any of you read Porno?
No.
Not read Trainspotting either.
Okay. Well, you should, honestly, you should read... Now you've seen T2, I can't recommend you read Porno enough, because it is hilarious. But Kelly MacDonald in this, when he comes back, she's doing her master's. She's still living in Edinburgh as a student. And he shacks up with her and starts shagging her again.
Hmm.
So
okay.
Completely different timelines, completely different universe.
Yeah.
But, yeah. When you look at their careers, she's probably the one who's doing best of all at the moment, isn't she? You not think?
Is she? Do you reckon?
Yeah, you know, she's doing... I think she is. I think we said this before on the podcast, maybe a year or more ago, that everyone else in this film needed this apart from Kelly MacDonald.
What's she doing particularly at the moment, then?
You're going to put me on the spot now. I can't remember.
But yeah, last thing I remember seeing her was Boardwalk Empire, which was quite nice.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I'm going to IMDb it because I'm...
Well, I mean, Johnny Lee Miller's been pretty... He's had a pretty good career lately, hasn't he?
It's taken him a long time to get that, though.
It did. Elementary helped. I saw him in a Danny Boyle-directed play of Frankenstein with him and Benedict Cumberbatch. And,
I was going to say Dracula 2000, but he Johnny Lee Miller.
No, or what the fuck was that? Dark Shadows. No, not that either. But I think he's a really good actor, Johnny Lee Miller, particularly so in the Trainspotting films, obviously. I think Ewan McGregor as well. I mean, he didn't need to do this, did he?
I don't know. His career, he's not gone great guns. The last thing I think I saw him in was Snowpiercer.
Ewan McGregor was in Snowpiercer?
I thought you said Ewan Bremner.
Oh, no. I was going
to
say...
Oh, yeah, Ewan McGregor didn't need to do this. No. You know, in terms of... He's doing great work. Although I did see his directorial debut the other night. It was all right.
Yeah, what was that?
American Pastoral.
Oh, yeah.
I think Ewan Bremner steals every scene he's in, as he did in the first one. He's the one I don't not feel sorry for, but he's the one I think who should be doing bigger and better things, but he's typecast as Spud.
Yeah, I think that's his problem, isn't he? He's also got a very distinctive look he's not a very versatile look to him, is it?
Weirdest thing. I think he was in Black Hawk Down. That was the weirdest thing I ever was like, what the fuck is Spud doing in a war film?
Yeah.
And I think everyone else thought that as well, and it probably killed his career at that point.
Black Hawk Down's got loads of people like that, but anyway, don't digress too much.
Yeah.
But yeah, he very talented guy and a great actor, but he is forevermore going to be Spud, unfortunately. It's such a lovable character.
Mm. And then the rest of the kind of supporting cast, Shirley Henderson, she was barely in it as Spud's long-suffering girlfriend, Gail.
Mm.
And Irvin Welsh, of course, as Mikey Forrester. Do you remember him in the first one?
Yes.
Yep, he sells him the suppositories, doesn't he? And he really says to him, I might as well stick him up my fucking ass. That was weird seeing him as like this kind of weird
meathead.
Yeah, kind of in a lockup full of dodgy fridges and stuff.
Yeah.
But other than that, the cast was tight and small. Like, they kept the money, you know, the budget down on the cast, for sure.
Mm, mm.
And one thing about this that's going to end up really well is it now makes me want to go out and buy a Gucci belt. Thanks, sick boy.
I am going to go and buy the soundtrack on vinyl, but it's not out till June.
Which
is really annoying.
You've got to shift those CDs first before they let you have the good stuff.
I know. So was it a thumbs up from everyone? Or apart from...
I give it a thumbs up, but it won't be one I'll rewatch time and time again like the first one.
It's definitely the one that has been released this year that I've enjoyed watching the most. You know, I liked stuff like Silence. I kind of liked Jackie for all I said about it earlier. I thought it was a little bit dull, but I mean, it's just a completely different sort of film to those.
Yeah. One thing I will say about it is that despite all the little flaws that I've highlighted, its ending is equally as satisfying as the first one. And I'll leave it at that. It ends on a really good note.
Yep. I'm hoping that perhaps maybe Netflix or someone else will step in and pick up some of this expanded Trainspotting universe. And because I know you haven't read the books, but I so want you guys to share Juice Terry Lawson with me, because he is the greatest character that Irvin Welsh has ever created, but you're yet to see him on screen, even though he was central to this story. He was completely wiped from it, but he is in the others, and I think he's got so many fingers in all these different stories that he would be great for a Netflix original. You heard it here second, because I've already heard from someone else.
That is almost all for this week's podcast, but we've just got some recommendations for the week ahead. Paul, what are you going to tell people to watch?
Rats on Netflix. Morgan Spurlock. Absolutely the most fucking disgusting, horrendous thing I've ever seen in my life. The closest I've ever been to being sick watching a film. It's just horrendous. Yeah, watch it.
Okay, Matt?
Yeah, I'm going to go for Saturday the 4th of February on Viceland, of all channels. 10 p.m. Battle Royale.
Oh, nice.
Very nice.
Owen?
Birdman has just been added to Netflix, which was our 9th best film of 2015. If anyone wants to look at our awards page on failedcritics.com.
That's the most tenuous plug there in the history of this podcast.
Yeah. Basically, what I was teeing up there was that I've updated the awards page on the Fail Critics on the Fail Critics website now, so you can see everything that won in 2016. So,
and I'm going to go for just Thursday night, switch your brain off, watch the remake of Red Dawn on 5-star at 9 o'clock.
Excellent.
Perfect.
Well, I liked Red Dawn. I liked the original as well. Both kind of decent action films. What have we got next week, Owen?
Next week, we've got kind of two things. I hope two things, anyway. We'll see how
the
it turns out.
The prawn special.
The prawn special. That's not happening. Stop trying to make it happen, Paul.
Paul, when he's away 1 week.
He's going to come back and find it uploaded to the feed.
So what we'll do is we'll just record one and pretend it's the real one for him to edit.
Yeah, you tried that when I wasn't here.
Did we?
Yeah, what was it you were trying to review? Emmanuel Films or something? Yeah, didn't happen in the end. So next week, hopefully we'll have a live episode recorded of sorts, or maybe even a video episode. And our regular episode will come back and we'll have Brooker and John Miller on it talking about the new Resident Evil film. So, yeah, two things hopefully to come out next week.
There we go. Thank you all for listening and joining us on this adventure in film. We'll be back next week with what Owen's just spoken about. Say goodbye, everyone, with your best Begbie impression.
Choose life, you fucker!
Jesus Christ.
That lassie got glassed.
No cunts live until the right fucking... Oh, I can't remember what the quote is. You get the point.
Yes, thank you. Good night.
Good night.
The Failed Critics podcast is presented by Steve Norman and Owen Hughes. created by James Diamond, with original music provided by Kevin McLeod of Incompetech.com, remixed by James Yule of JamesYule.com. You can find us at failedcritics.com, on Twitter at failedcritics, and Facebook at facebook.com/failedcritics. Thanks for listening.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.